If I'm going to die, what do I want to leave for my kids? Especially as a single mom, it just became really important to me to figure out what legacy do I want to leave.
Another Kind of Mother is about rewriting the scripts around our ideas of mother and mothering across cultures, historically and spiritually, in order to free both women and men from within the constraints of a dying paradigm. And all of this in service to creating a more beautiful world. I'm Delphine, and I'm really glad you're here.
My guest today is Laura Pine. And Laura Pine comes to us today with, as she explained it, a trifecta of different aspects of the relationship with mother and mothering. She has two daughters, a 9-year-old and an 18-year-old, and she has metastatic breast cancer. And what we're going to talk about today is the result of the experience of this, receiving this diagnosis, how she has woven that experience into creating something that sounds like a beautiful gift for initially her two daughters, but ultimately the entire world, I would imagine. So Laura, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Delphine. Thank you for having me on. I'm really grateful to be here.
I'm so grateful to have you here as well. And I want to thank you for your willingness to be vulnerable, to talk about a topic that so few of us are willing to talk about in such an honest manner. And I think it's conversations like these that break down those barriers and allow us to be more real about what is real, instead of feeling like we've got to tiptoe and hold it all inside ourselves and not talk about these verboten topics like death, like cancer, mm-hmm. like what is our legacy?
Right.
Thank you. We touched on this just before we dove in here. You have written this book, and I'd like to explore what this process was in terms of starting with your, well, first of all, you had been working as a life coach.
I wasn't a life coach quite yet. I was working for the life coach company as a writer, trying to figure out how to get to open my life coach practice. I just wasn't there yet.
And then when you received your diagnosis, what happened?
Yes. And then in June of 2022, I received just a devastating diagnosis of metastatic breast cancer. I had gone through breast cancer the first time in 2017. And had surgery, mastectomy, surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, the whole nine yards, and thought, okay, that's behind me. You know, we can move forward now. Yet, I think as a breast cancer survivor, it's always in the back of one's mind of, is this going to come back? And then in June of 2022, when it did in fact come back, I look back now, and as I mentioned earlier, for 6 months, I crumbled in depression and anxiety, and I still functioned in terms of being able to take care of my kids because I still wanted to show up for them. That was at the forefront of what I wanted to do, is be a mom. I had very little energy for anything else, and especially was my older daughter's senior year. And so I didn't want to miss out on anything that any of the celebrations, anything that she was experiencing, it was so important for me to be present for both my kids. But I wish I could tell you that I got the diagnosis and my faith carried me through and I knew everything was going to be okay, but I crumbled. I crumbled for that 6 months and I questioned my faith. Every day was a different dark night of the soul. Every day seemed to be darker than the previous day. And I just was spiraling. And for the first time in my life, I've been through a lot of tough things. And for the first time in my life, I thought, I don't see a way out. I don't see a way out. This is not going to end well. And so what happened was, and basically at, you know, that 6 months, all I could do is, like I said, I was able to take care of my kids, but I sat at the kitchen table and sobbed. And then I'd pull myself together. My kids would be at school and I'd pull myself together and, you know, act like everything was okay because mom needs to be strong because I'm a single mom as well. And that was the first 6 months. And then I think what happened was I finally, a few things clicked and I thought, okay, if this is my life and I've got an expiration date out there that I didn't know what it was, because when I got my diagnosis, I did not ask how long do I have, because I did not want to know. I didn't want that timestamp put on my life, because they always say, believe the diagnosis, but don't believe the prognosis. So I didn't want any sort of mental barrier, you know, and it's such a paradox and a dichotomy, because usually one of the first comments I get when someone does find out I have metastatic breast cancer is, well, you look so healthy. And ironically enough, I feel healthy most of the time. The drugs usually do a number on me. But anyway, what happened was, after that 6 months, I thought, okay, I need to move on. And if I'm going to die, what do I want to leave for my kids? Especially as a single mom, it just became really important to me to figure out, what legacy do I want to leave? And I toyed with writing letters, you know, they could open a letter for every birthday after I've died, and that could be a piece of my heart. And that just didn't really align with where I was. And so I started just journaling, just kind of stream of consciousness, writing words on a page about, you know, it was 54 years of life lessons that I had learned. And unfortunately, I hadn't learned them until probably well into my 40s. And I wish I had learned them when I was 21 or 18 or in high school, because honestly, my life would have been a lot easier and a lot different, I think, had I had these different areas of emotional intelligence that I write about, had I been aware of these areas. And what happened over the course of just unloading my mind onto the page, you know, it was just really brutal honesty and life lessons that I wish I had. And I wrote about resilience and boundaries and self-respect and self-care and self-love, all the things that I wish I had done and known about years ago. And in that process, it really helped me unravel my poor mental state, the dark mental state that I was in. And just being a life coach, it helped me feel like okay, well, these are things that, you know, not only do I want to leave for my kids in written form, but I need to start, you know, talking to them again about these things. Because when I was going through my life coaching training, I would, you know, talk to them about some things, but I lost my energy. I just didn't have the energy to try to teach them and talk with them. And so I got this renewed energy about, wait a minute, this is the value that I can bring, because I was spinning in that, okay, I've been handed a death sentence. What do I have left to give? What value can I give to not only my kids, but anybody? And so the text, the words on a page, started shaping up, and I had one of those 3 o'clock in the morning moments to where I woke up and I thought, I think I might have a book here. And, you know, what I'd love is it means I could sell maybe at least 3 copies, because my children would hopefully each buy one for each kid. And then, you know, if it could help one other person, it would serve its purpose. And so that really helped give me a renewed purpose, a renewed hope. It helped me to focus more on the present moments and the now rather than this angel of death that, you know, was knocking on my door.
Beautiful. I presume, are your kids aware of you doing this work in the background, or is this something you've discussed with them?
They know I'm writing a book and it's almost finished. And I've shared my little one, my third grader. She's so funny because she's like, well, mama, I know you took your life coach training and now you can, you know, really help me like you helped sister. And with my older one, I've sent her a couple of topics. For example, you know, she was really struggling with feeling convicted that she needs to diversify in her friendship group and get different types of people around her. And one of the chapters I wrote was, you become like the 5 people you surround yourself with. So I sent her that chapter, and you know, I hope it helped. I just with teenagers, it's sometimes you don't always get, I didn't send it to get feedback. I sent it because I wanted to put it out there. You know, I mean, she was very complimentary, but I was like, well, hopefully, you know, it'll set in. And she's read a chapter I wrote. She was doing a college essay and they were talking about values. And I had written a chapter on values with some exercises. And I know that really helped her because she read that one right in front of me. So they do know, they know I'm writing. They're very excited for me. I think I have downplayed, and I believe this is the right thing to do. You know, they already know I have a deadly disease. So I don't just overtly want to say, oh, and this is what I want to leave behind when I'm gone. You'll have this book. Because I don't want them on a day-to-day basis to have those reminders. Especially my little one, because I walk a tightrope of, with both of them actually, being honest about my diagnosis and yet also casting hope with both of them. Because kids usually want to know what's going to happen and what's the outcome. And the best I can do is say, I'm trying the best I can to get healthy, and I'm so grateful I can take care of you every day. And, you know, all we know is that we have today and we have next week and we probably have, you know, several months. And so they know what I'm doing, but I've downplayed the legacy part just because I don't want to have them faced with that huge shot of reality, because they already are dealing with so much. Having a mom with a deadly disease, I can't imagine. You know, I know there's a lot of fear they both carry. I know with my little one, he's, you know, had meltdowns to where she's like, "Mommy, please don't die. I need you." And, you know, and that it's really, so they're carrying a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned one of your daughters is adopted. Is it the older or the younger?
It's my younger one. Yes, she was adopted at 3 months old. And she's, you know, so well adjusted. So she's a miracle. This is a whole other podcast, probably, because this child is just a miracle. And she's just very, very well adjusted, you know, socially, gets along fine with everybody. She's really defied the odds because she had a really rough start. She was, I think I said she was adopted at 3 months. And yeah, but even, you know, I think with her, that's so much to carry for her, knowing, okay, I'm adopted, you know, and by the way, my parents are divorced now. And now my mom has a deadly disease. I mean, that's a lot for a little kid to carry. And so that's where I'm so grateful that I do look healthy. I do act healthy. Yes, sometimes I get so tired. And she does see that, because I kind of can't hide that from her, you know? But by and large, I try to downplay my symptoms and the way I'm feeling, because that's the right thing to do for me in my situation.
In the moment.
Yes. Yeah.
Being at your healthiest, best.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I get the piece about, you know, especially for an adopted child, the abandonment issues, as much as we can try to address those in all of the ways that we do, it's something that never, ever goes away when they don't
Yes.
have their original birth parent.
Right, exactly. And we both know at our age, we all have abandonment issues, but it's just, I believe they're exacerbated with adoption. And, you don't know. So far, I think that will creep out more as she reaches the teenage years. But so far, thank goodness, you know, like I said earlier, she's very well adjusted. I can't ask for anything else with regards to both my children, because they're both thriving and doing very well. So I'm so grateful for that. And it also allows me to have more energy for myself, that's, you know, to take care of myself more. So they're awesome kids, and they're not perfect, but they usually make my job a lot easier.
Do you have, in terms of, as we said at the top, you know, you've been very generous in your honesty and your transparency in terms of speaking about the reality of this. For other women, for other people in across the board who may be going through something like this, are there upsides and downsides? Are there things that you've learned that you would do differently in terms of these conversations? Are there?
That's a really good question. You know, It's so difficult because this was never a story that I ever would have chosen for myself or anybody else for that matter. But it has carried me to my purpose. Because before this, before my diagnosis, I was stalled and I was floundering. And then, even I mentioned before, even after my diagnosis, I was stalled and I was floundering. But now I feel like it has ignited a passion within me to put something out there to the world. And the line that is at the forefront of my mind is, we all have gifts that the world desperately needs. And we all need to try to get those gifts out there. And our life is a gift. And the gifts that we have when we can share those is our gift back to the world. But I don't think I'm answering your question. Did you ask what advice I would give to?
Are there things that in the process of this learning, this discovery, that you might in retrospect have done differently? Or is there advice in the way that you have done this that you would share with others that might be going through a similar experience?
I think, like any mom, some regrets I have are, and usually this was with my oldest, just, having that feeling, which I often still have today. I feel like if you envision a pitcher, my pitcher is usually full. Because I'm just completely maxed out. I feel like I'm carrying around five suitcases with my health battle. And when and it's so difficult because I used to be one of those people that I could have 12 balls in the air and I can handle them all beautifully. And this has really caused me to realize my limitations. I've learned how to say no, that I can't juggle like that anymore because I will fail with flying colors. And that's okay because I'm already going through a lot. And so I wish I would have given myself that space and that grace to realize what a heavy load I was carrying. I realize that now. But especially with my older one, I think the pitcher would I'd try to take on too much and then stuff would start sloshing out and I just wouldn't be able to handle stuff. And it would come out in, maybe sharp words. And it didn't happen a whole lot, thank goodness. And I know normal moms, even not with this diagnosis, that happens. But I definitely wish, like I said, I could have pulled back early on and just thought, I really need to give myself a break here and some space and time. But like I said, it was my daughter's senior year. I was all in, and with that, I had no regrets. I wanted to be all in. It was such a blessing for me. And I think one of the things that I did well, and this happened organically. It's ironic because, even as being the single mom, my house ended up being the place where all the kids came to hang out. And I'm probably going to start crying. That was a breath of life for me to hear the kids talking and laughing and having fun and enjoying themselves. And it was a lifeline when I needed it so much. And even my little one, they were so gracious, usually about including her. And so that helped me because I thought they're both happy, you know, and I could see that happiness and absorb it in real time. And so I would say to anybody, try to, you know, support is so, so essential. And I'm really fortunate in that I don't have a significant other, but I have a lot of really wonderful friends that are very supportive and that, you know, give me space when I need it. And when I don't need it, they're here for, you know, when I need to talk or I need something, they're here for me. And so I would tell someone going through this to get your support network and keep it going, because I still to this day realize how important it is. And it's just a gift. And I take care to honor that support network and make sure that I feed that support network. It's mutual. Even though I'm going through this, no, when they need something, it's not a one-way thing. I'm there for them as well. It's everything is reciprocal. It has to be. And I think the other thing that someone going through this, you know, again, I touched on this earlier, is believe the diagnosis, but don't ever believe the prognosis. I struggle with this. I'm still trying to do this, but I'm a follower of Joe Dispenza, who I went to his retreat last year, and he always says, lean into the unknown. It will never let you down. And I love that line. And I think, okay, that's a bit extreme, because I'm having to lean into, I don't know when my expiration date is, but that's okay. That's my unknown. That's my reality. And it does help me let go of the outcome. You know, it's so weird to feel that way, but I can't focus on when is this party going to end. I have to focus on, let's enjoy this party. And this party for today is good, and it's rocking, and it's happening.
What an incredible, courageous inspiration you are in all of this.
Oh, thank you.
And I love, you know, what might be counterintuitive as, you know, a parent of another kid, maybe thinking, oh, you know, all the kids over at her house might be too much. And yet that was a gift for you in welcoming all of that as, yeah.
Yeah, it was very, very life-giving, very life-giving, just to have a full house with happiness is such a gift. And I miss it now. My little one has friends over, you know, as often as we can, but it's different with teenagers, you know, and I'll get there again one day when my little one, you know, when she can drive. And so I'll be there again one day, but yeah, it's really, really fond memories and really, really fun.
Beautiful. So your book is called Mastering the Pivot into Your Future.
Yes.
I know there's a very long subtitle. Help me with that one.
Okay. So it's called Mastering the Pivot into Your Future. And then the subtitle is 25 Essential Life Skills You Need to Live Well and Be Happy. And so this first book, I actually have, it'll be this first book. And then I immediately have a second book of 25 topics. They're both going to be structured the same way. And it's in essay format. And it is not a book about me. It is not my life stories. I actually wanted to remove myself from it. And basically, the topics are, for example, I am enough. It's designed to let the reader know, I was born enough. I am enough now. What to do if you don't feel like you're enough, how to get the feeling that you are enough. And so every chapter is structured so that number one, hopefully they'll read it and they'll think, this idea changed my life. And it's structured to where, it says, this is what the emotional, this is what the topic is of emotional intelligence. This is why you need it. This is how to get it and how to build those muscles. And then there's usually some self-reflection questions included that, the reader can think about when, whenever, when they have time.
And is this geared toward the 9-year-old or the 18-year-old or somewhere in between or both?
I'm thinking my target market is probably early high school, so freshmen, maybe the mature junior high kid, but my idea was, starting freshman in high school and then anywhere upwards of late 20s. Because, you've got so many pivotal moments in those years. You've got freshman high school, you're a fresh fish out of water. You need to learn a lot about emotional intelligence and social development to make your way through. And then, senior year, you graduate and you either go on to college or you start working. And so regardless, you're in different environments. And so you again need to know, what do I need to be aware of here? What, one of the chapters, which is really, and this is probably, this is a whole book that I want to write, is it's dealing with predators. I was never aware of what a predator is and how they disguise themselves. And boy, and I consider myself very, very fortunate. Nothing, quote unquote, bad ever happened. It could have because I was in the line of fire, but I didn't know that that's what was happening. I didn't know I was being preyed upon. And I think if kids are given these topics ahead of time, to where when they're in a situation, they can think, wait a minute, wait a minute. I know somewhere at some point I read something about this, then they'll have a frame of reference. And, one of the, as I was deciding on my niche, one of the things that really struck me was counseling is what, I'm probably going to misquote this, but it's got to be a $1 billion industry. Billion. And when I was figuring out my niche, I thought, how amazing would that be if we as a society could get in front of, teach these kids these emotional intelligence topics to where they would not be, they could avoid being damaged. And you can't avoid everything, I know that, but avoid some damages to where they wouldn't have to go run to counseling, because counseling is reactive. And I'm not bad mouthing counseling. It's an amazing tool. But I just, that was kind of my flighty dream. I was like, how amazing if you could save, one kid from, he could, he or she could get in front of whatever they're experiencing and be like, I know I'm aware of this topic. So I don't have to go down that rabbit trail. I can, pull myself away from whatever is dragging me into this dark spot. And so they wouldn't have to go run to counseling to help them process through something and be put back together. I don't know if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yes, it's preventive awareness without creating paranoia.
Right.
Saying this exists. And
right.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Yeah, when there is that ping of awareness, oh yeah, this looks like that thing. This feels like that thing. And I'm with you. I'm 12 years older than you are, but never having had any awareness of what that looked like, because it was so prevalent in the culture. I don't think people had even labeled or named things like that then.
Right, right. And one of the buzzwords now, I know we've all heard, my 18-year-old, you know, as she starts to date, one of the chapters is red flags and relationships. So she'll be relaying me a story about, you know, this person did this, or you know, this is the situation. And I'll say, that's a red flag. You know, that's a red flag. And when somebody shows you a red flag, you really need to pay attention. They're showing you who they are. And so I always try to use those moments as teachable moments. But yeah, as kids start to date, to know, what is a boundary? How do I say no? You know, not just to a sexual advance, but to a, no, I can't go out with you tonight. I have to work, or I have to study. Or so it's having the emotional intelligence topics are designed to empower and to give kids agency over themselves, kind of as a guide, if you will, of navigating life and ultimately navigating relationships within that life. Because a lot of the writing is very relationship driven, and which our whole lives are that way. You know, we're meant to live in community. And unfortunately, when we hit a rough spot, it's not always because of another person, but I mean, lots of times it is. And so if you can be aware of, you know, what's out there, then hopefully the goal is to pave the way to make it easier for this group of young people.
And as you said, these are topics that are not generally covered in school.
No.
They're not a part of our education.
No, because the kids think, I have to be so nice. If someone's mean to me, now I have to turn the other cheek and let them continue to be mean. No, you don't. No, you don't. It's called a boundary. And it's called being able to remove yourself from the situation. It's a different set of skills that they need for good social adjustments.
And the piece around self-love, having that piece in place so that you feel you have the right to set a boundary.
Yes.
Again, something we're not taught. Like you said, turn the other cheek, be nice, you know.
Right. Right. And being able to, you know, pan the camera back and say, is this action kind to myself? Is this loving to myself? I never knew that. You know, I thought it was, you know, give it my all to everybody to the point of exhaustion. And I think not everybody is that way, but I think especially women and especially mothers are taught that. Give your all to everybody and then you get it last. And even in doing this writing, it really helped me, you know, the self-love chapter, the self-love / self-care chapter. I was like, I need to do better here. And it is not selfish to take care of myself. In fact, it's especially in my situation, it is exactly what I need. So I think to echo what you said, it's giving us permission to be able to carry out these things to take better care of ourselves.
And in your case, you know, teaching what you need to learn, seeing the reflection in your own writing.
Yes.
You know, as we give advice to others, it's just like, what's the mirror saying back to me here?
Right. You're so right. Yes.
And hearing that distinction that keeps coming up about nice versus kind. A teacher of mine talks about, you know, something being kind can be very sharp feeling, but clear, versus nice is kind of being a doormat, you know? Being nice is what we're often taught, but being kind requires kindness to the self and honoring of the self first, and then being kind to others.
Yes, absolutely. And what came up when you were saying that is it's having an astuteness about yourself to where you can be kind, but you know where to draw the line in the sand, and you know where it becomes okay. Well, now you're not being kind to yourself because you're being so kind to the other person. You're losing yourself in that.
Yeah, and that's not nice.
And that's not, exactly, it's not nice. Yeah, and so to have, you know, even my little one, one of the things I'm working with her on is not being responsible for other people's feelings. Because at this age, it's, you know, there's a lot of hurt around so-and-so said this and it, you know, hurt my feelings. And I was trying to help somebody else feel better, which is so sweet at that age. It's really sweet. But I try to teach her. I'm like, you know, it, obviously you want to help people and you want them to feel better. But I said, ultimately, you're not responsible for them. And, you know, you can, I definitely encourage you to go to them and help them and, you know, encourage them, but ultimately it's not up to you. You know, they're their own person and their feelings aren't your fault. And it's not up to you to manage that. So I'm trying to, in a third grade way, you know, whenever I get teaching opportunities, you know, I always try to, my kids probably get so sick of it, but I try to drop nuggets in. What's wild, I have to say this real quick, with my oldest, what's wild is when I've noticed a few times she has regurgitated back things that I've told her. And I'm like, all right, she was listening. You know, she was listening. You don't think they're listening, and you never know. You know, they're like sponges. You never know what are they disgusted over. Oh, mom, you know, what are they really hearing? But it's so cool when she actually regurgitates something back to me, and I'm like, oh, you were listening. You know,
your children chose well.
Oh.
Choosing their mother. What a beautiful gift in this incredibly challenging and painful situation that you are going through, to be able to see the light in it, to be able to see the gifts in the despair.
Mm-hmm.
And not, and to collapse under the weight of that, I'm sure it's an up and down and up and down and up and down process, but to be able to come up enough to offer a gift like this is so courageous. Thank you, Laura.
Well, thank you for saying that. You know, I think one of the other things I want to throw in is it is an up and down process. And that will probably be that way for the duration, but I feel I've made progress, because it's the old saying of, you know, you walk down a dark lane and you fall into the hole, and you do that a couple of times, and then you walk down the dark lane and you know the hole is there, so you walk around it, and you do that a couple of times, and then one day you're like, I'm not doing this anymore, and you take a different street. And so I feel when I think about the way I'm handling the diagnosis emotionally, I'm getting better at navigating it. You know, I still crumple, which I think is normal. And again, that'll probably always happen, but I'm getting better about not staying in that crumpled place because I don't want to waste the time. Time is at a premium, but guess what? Time is at a premium for everybody. Everybody. And one of my friends that has, she also has metastatic breast cancer. She said it so well. She said, and we just happened to be kicking back, drinking wine. And she said, you know, sometimes I wonder if we aren't the lucky ones, because we realize that time is fleeting and it makes us live more full, and we take more chances and opportunities and quicker than the average person, because we're like, yeah, let's do it. You know, let's get on with it. Let's dive in there and do it. So I thought that was really poignant that, you know, am I one of the lucky ones? I don't consider the cancer, I consider it an enemy, but the enemy has offered unmeasurable gifts. And I think that is one of the things that life is all about, and trying to accept those gifts is a whole other thing, instead of just saying, which is what I did early on, no, I don't want any of this. No, I'm not going to accept this. This can't happen. Once you reach that point of acceptance, the floodgates kind of open up and it puts a different slant on things.
Thanks for joining me on Another Kind of Mother. If you enjoyed the podcast and can review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, it'll help this message reach more people. And a special thanks to Wendy Colonna for our theme song called Shine.